And we will endeavor to understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2025. This is night 3, and there are 4 interviews coming up tonight. In 2 hours from now, it'll be Elizabeth Heverin, and then Norman Eckert, and then the alternative hypothesis, Ryan Falk. But first, I am here with a regular favourite on Millennial, Dangerfield. Chris Dangerfield. Chris, welcome back to Millennial.
It's an absolute privilege and a pleasure to be here. I say it every year, but apart from when I was in hospital last year, I've had 8 on the bounce, I think, and there'll be that one year where I'm just not wanted anymore. So,
I doubt it. I doubt it. You're a staple of Millennial.
Lovely.
But yeah, you've had quite a time, and it is a shame about last year. But it's the like Robin Riley can't make it this year, for example, and you know, it happens. There are always these ups and downs, so don't worry about it. I think everyone knows that you are a favorite, a regular face on Millennial, and that will never change. So there we go. Why don't you introduce yourself to anyone who unbelievably doesn't know about you?
There was an amazing little sort of wry smile when you said that would never change then. Your expression didn't correlate what you're saying. I'm Chris Dangerfield. I was once a communist. I like to get that in early before I get accused of it. But I was like 24, and now I'm like 100 or something. I'm a really old man. I've been YouTubing forever as well. Feels like it. I'm a writer. I'm a storyteller. And I've just released a new novel. And it's blown up incredibly. Far, far more than I would have ever expected. It's an anomaly in the self-publishing game. My first novel was traditionally published, and it was in Waterstones. I mean, this is going back a while. And, you know, brick and mortar bookstores, Foils and that, all in on Charing Cross Road. There used to be about 9 bookshops, like 3 Waterstones, a couple of Borders, Foils. And if I was entertaining a young lady, I'd quickly get up the Charing Cross Road and go to all the bookshops and put my book face up rather than spine. And I'd just say to her, I've booked us a nice seat at a restaurant. I said, I've just got to grab this book. Get into the shops, literary fiction section, just sort of linger until she went, is that the same? And I'd go, oh, no way, that's still in stock. Wow. And no way did I do that about 20 times, yeah. But it was one of the things that I haven't had the ability to do this time not being in London is the guerrilla marketing I'd done for that first novel was incredible. I was living in a squat in Bethnal Green, and there was about 8 of us in there. You wouldn't have known it was a squat. It wasn't full of people doing ketamine and like telling you, you know, about Dog Star is actually a radio. Beautiful old Edwardian house, wooden floors throughout, freestanding bath in the middle of this huge room. Just a gorgeous house on the old Full Road, which runs parallel to Roman Road, if anyone knows that part of London. And why did I mention that? Oh, yeah. So what I did was was it full scep or A3, A4? I can't remember, doesn't matter. Got loads of, I got the barcode printed, and I got a really good review in ID magazine by the bloke who at the time was the director of the ICA in London. And the review, I know off by art, which is awful, because it was like 30 years ago. It was something like, had Justin Kerrigan, the novel was called Tired, etc. And it was, had Justin Kerrigan read Tired, etc., he would never have bothered writing a human traffic screenplay, an absolutely side-splitting, deriving Dolesville with two perpetually caned skunk growers with their own take on Thatcherism. Can't remember the next bit, but the juice was at the bottom where he says, which is why this slight genius volume warms, then wallops like a Durban poison blunt, of which loads here. When you're 23 and the director of the Institute of Contemporary Art says genius, I was drunk for about 3 years. That was just a party. So I put that review and the ISBN number. It wasn't on Amazon then. Like I say, it was brick and mortar bookstores. I had one of those, you know, those stamps. I feel so old having to explain things. You used to be able to get rubber stamps made up, people, and you put them on an ink pad and then you'd put them on a bit of paper. I got one of them made up with the title and the ISBN number, and I'd just do the London Underground every day. You know, when you go up the escalators, there's all those little adverts on paper. Every day. But those bits of paper with the review, the name of the novel, my name and the ISBN number, they were then all cut out into bits of paper about that big, which we folded into cocaine bindles. And anyone who does cocaine will recognise a cocaine bindle like a mile off. And we folded up about, it was over 10,000. It took about a week for the eight of us to just sit there cutting our fingers to pieces. Nice, like, paper cuts and all sorts. I didn't pay any of them anything for doing it either. And then we went around London just throwing them in pub toilets, restaurant toilets. We done all the members' clubs. Like, not like five, or that wouldn't work. It was a strange sort of logic there, but just one, you know, someone will go down. And I saw people do it as well. We'd leave them outside bars and that, and it a little bit like when you, there was a fiver on the floor and you're a kid and you sort of move over to it gradually, put your foot on it. Is this a trick? Am I being watched? And then, oh, I better do my shoelace up. People were doing that sort of thing with them. And of course, when they get home and they think, wicked, I got myself half a gram of possibly the worst recreational drug ever invented. No, you've been ad, mate. This is an advert. And that, it really worked, you know. It flew. And we got these, this isn't great marketing, but there's a little story afterwards that is. I got a lot of postcards made up, and, you know, it said on the front, and it was written like a stoner because the novel was about a couple of people who grew weed. And it said, dear God, get me 120 quid a week, half ounce of skunk, half ounce of speed and some porn or you're dead. And then on the back it had the review and all that. And I made them, I had them made so that they were the perfect size. When you're on the London Underground, you sit down and that view, because you're not going to look at the person in front of you because humans don't like each other. So you look at, you've got that little bit above the person and that's where all the adverts are. But these cards, you could shove them in the top bit, slight bend, and they'd sit in the bottom bit. And we'd go to the end of the Northern Line or the end of the District and Circle. We're at the end of all the lines. We actually did, literally, not figuratively. I wasn't at the end of the line. But as soon as the tube come in and the doors open, we all run in, like two or three of us, and put as many of those in as we could. And then those adverts were sent through the whole of London. And then when the next tube come in, we'd done it as well. So it's a shame I haven't had that this time, the ability to do that guerrilla marketing, because it can be really effective. People respond well to it because, you know, advertising has invaded public space. It's everywhere. You know, public space has been consumed by advertising. So with the bindle more than the just saturation, it was really effective. But this time, having none of that, I have got kind of a footprint in the UK. I was a comedian, for professional comedian, for, well, I'd done it for about 10 years, but I'd only say I was a pro for about six of those, because obviously you learn your trade on the job with stand-up, which is horrible. You know, musicians sit at home learning all to, you know, play their guitar, and then when they're excellent, they get on stage. But as a comedian, you have to get up there not knowing how to do it. And, yeah, a lot of people say to me that's their worst fear ever, the thought of doing that. And even as a comic who'd done it for 10 years, you know, sometimes gigging 3, 4, 5 times a week at the Edinburgh Fringe, doing 60 gigs in 3 or 4 weeks, that fear doesn't go away, you know, and you will have bad gigs. So it's horrible. But so,
brutal.
I'll let me finish this, or I'll just keep wandering. And if I do wander too far, get me back in lane. But so I have a little bit of a footprint in the UK from YouTube. I've been on telly a few times, on loads of radio stuff, and obviously a few other little bits and bobs. But in America, nothing. So when my novel, the new one, oh, hi, that's it there, Love in the Time of Nudie Mags, it went to number one in the new releases in America. I've got no footprint in America. About 6% of my YouTubers are American, and they're not going to, if they bought 5 copies each, that's not gonna do that. It's got a quote from Will Self on the cover. Will Self's not known in America, you know. So that was mind blowing, absolutely mind blowing. And
how did that happen?
Well, this is the question I've been asking. I mean, I broke all the rules of self-publishing. I broke all of them. Don't design your own cover. I mean, I did go to art college for 6 years, so maybe I'm in a slightly different group there, but never, don't design your own cover. Even the blurb on the back, the last 2 lines of the blurb are, actually, spare me the blurb, this book probably isn't for you. You know, that's a risk. It's a risky thing to say. It's probably not for you. But I you know, put that with the title, target a certain audience. And then it went.
Let's see the cover again.
Sure.
That's a good cover. I mean, that's a good design.
I can't take full credit. It's a pastiche of Philip Roth, the American writer's Portnoy's Complaint. So,
right.
Okay. I mean, okay. I still did design it, but yeah, it is quite nice.
Nice.
I mean, you look at a lot of self-published covers, and it's like, oh man, come on! It looks like a local church publication, and they could do us some help. But what was I saying before you asked to look at the cover?
About the footprint in America. And oh, yeah, the blurb putting people away.
Well, then that new release thing on American Amazon is they estimate between 5,000 and 9,000 books are uploaded every day. Yeah, so that puts it in a bit of context. Now I sort of am taking credit for it, but it has shocked me. You know, I think I'm a good writer, otherwise I wouldn't do it. You know, what's the point? You know, I'm not very good at bricklaying, so I wouldn't lay bricks. But it was amazing. You went to my page, and next to the title, it said hashtag #1 in new releases. And I was just like, hey, refresh. This is a glitch in the system. And then in America, it went to number 81 in British literary fiction. Traditional publishers with named well-known authors who upload onto Amazon, they struggle to get into the top 1,000. You know, it's very difficult. But to get to 81, it had only been out, like, it had only been there, I think, that was about 5 days into the, it was released. In the UK, it's doing well, but not that well. In the UK, I think it's currently, well, it moves daily, but last time I looked, which is every 10 seconds, it was 117 in British literary fiction, something like 600 in dark humour. It peaked at about 110 in dark humour. But I was expecting this to happen over the year, you know, go on podcasts, do other things. I've got a couple of other little plans that I was thinking, you know, 3 months down the line. But to get those early rankings, I'm now in Amazon's algorithm sort of hotspot. They know that if they show my book, it sells. So my visibility goes through the roof. And you know, when you go on Amazon and it says, oh, people who bought this also bought this, I will now get a lot of that because I've proven that if it's seen, it's bought. Quite funny, when I bought my own copy, that one, it said people who bought this also bought, and it was one of Teddy Dutton's books. I can't remember what it was, but I thought, wow. Yeah. So, yeah, it's been
so,
quite the week.
Let's talk about the book itself then. I mean, is there anything more you'd want to say about this?
No. I'm very grateful. I think gratitude is an important thing in life. You know, I'm not being cool about it. I'm mind blown, very happy. I walked away from my business to be a full-time writer. I set up a business 20 years ago. It's been a very successful business, gave me a quality of life that I never thought I'd have. You know, I was a director of a limited company. I could go on holiday whenever I want, and I did. I was buying £4,000 bespoke suits, £2,000 pairs of shoes, which was actually a good investment because I've still got them, you know, by quality. I still wear them. They don't have much currency out here, though, to be honest with you. But I you know, for about the last year, I just thought I've had enough of this and I'm not getting any younger. You know, I've got two other novels that are almost finished. I've got an 800 pager that is like which is like my magnum opus. I've been working on it for 9 years, and it's a kind of picaresque sort of, dare I say, postmodern, but aware of its postmodernity. And it's first person present as well, which is clunky to write and clunky to read. It knows it's a novel, but I don't want to, as much as I'm really proud of that book, and it, you know, it doesn't even really need, how do I explain this? Because of the lack of, there's no hero's journey in that other book. It, like I say, it's a picaresque, it's like bosh, 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 bosh. I could just publish it, but I thought, I have to think tactically here. If I can build up an audience of a few more of these more accessible novels, then and build up a brand. And these are what you have to do these days, you know. And I hear a lot of writers complaining about it. Oh, you know, back in the old days, you just send a couple of, you know, bits of paper with some typing on to the publishers, and they'd go, yeah, we'll publish. And in 20 years, the young writers will be saying, oh, in the old days, you just have a YouTube channel and you could upload videos and then put a book on Amazon. It was easy. they'll see these as the glory days. So I try not to complain too much about that. But point being, for about the last year and a half, I was waking up on Monday mornings, 200 emails at least that need dealing with. And when you answer those, half of them, two-thirds of them are then going to come back. It's that conversation isn't sorted from one email. Then Slack if people don't know, Slack is what businesses use. Imagine X, but for your business. So you've got like rooms like marketing, finance, design, and all that sort of thing. But you can also DM people. It's how businesses communicate with their staff, because you can't run an e-commerce business anymore using email because it's too slow. I find that fascinating. You just couldn't do it. And anyway, I was just thinking, this isn't, you know, I've always wanted to be a writer. That first novel, I was 23 when I published that. And I have always written. My Substack has blown up incredibly well as well before this novel, which gave me a lot of encouragement. And then I just thought, you've got to take a risk now. You've got to... Are you still going to be working in this job in 10 years, not having enough time to write and put in the work to promote, and think, yeah, you fucked it up. You didn't do it. You lost your balls. And so I just one day said, hey, that's it. I'm done. And so I got all the staff together and said,
coming full circle or a repeat of what you did when you were 23, in the sense that that must have been a risk. That must have been pushing out into something that you'd never done before. You had no idea how it could turn out. You were doing things you'd never, like using tactics you'd never tried before, and having to basically do it yourself and organize that guerrilla marketing yourself. And it sounds like you've ventured to take a similar risk now, 30 years later.
I hadn't thought of it like that, and you're right. But taking risks when you're young, it's almost like you've got more time to sort of put things back together if they go wrong.
Oh yeah, but this is why I would never do drugs now. I would never take psychedelics now, because it's just when I was 20, 21, fine, but not now. There's too much to lose.
Right now, this is interesting. I've got a friend. He was an alcoholic, proper alcoholic. His novel had an introduction by Jeff Bezos and sold very well. And well done. Not bitter in any way, but well done. But he still will do psychedelics occasionally. And I said, you know, I sort of recoiled when he said it. I said, fuck that. I mean, at art school, I'd done more acid than anything else, you know, certainly more acid than art. And I said to him, I said, just like you said, I said, no way would I do that. He said, why? I said, because, you know, I've got this is my life and I've got this. And when I was a teenager or early 20s, there wasn't really a lot that I had to worry about. Does she love me or, you know, does she not? That was it, really. And he said, and that's exactly why you should do it. And I keep thinking about that, actually. He said, because when you're young, you're happy to have all your comforts questioned. But when you get a bit older, you're comfortable in that, no, I do this, I've got these habits. I don't mean habits as in like smoking, I mean habitual way of living. And I don't really want to question them. When you're 19, it's like, whoa, I get it. Oh, fuck, I'm not going to be like that anymore. And, you know, major sort of existential manoeuvres occur. And the thought of a major existential manoeuvre occurring at 53 is terrifying. But might be quite good, though. Not the actual experience, but your faith. Your faith said, no, it won't. It wouldn't be quite good.
I don't know. This is down to the individual, isn't it? You know, this might be a risk that is worth taking for some people. I'm not going to take the risk. I can't see myself doing it. But I don't want to get waylaid into this tangent,
sure,
because this should be about you and your book. So I said that you're kind of coming full circle in a sense. I don't want to put words in your mouth, obviously, but that's just how it seems.
I'll tell you what happened. I grew up in a working class family. We had two books in our house. This is actually in the novel. Two books. I mean, I was talking to Will Self the other week about, and he said, I don't give a fuck that you had two books in your house. He said, I was dealing with the fact I was reading Dosti. He said Dosti as well. I thought, oh, come on. I was reading Dosti at 11. I kind of understand his point, you know, oh, woe is me. I didn't read as a kid. But, you know, reading Dostoevsky at 12 is going to affect you as well, not necessarily positively. But the two books we had were Glamour Photography, hardback. and it wasn't really a how-to. It was just a hardback porn mag, really. And the LaRousse Gastronomique, a very famous French cookbook. But, I mean, my mum was a terrible cook, like frighteningly bad cook. And my dad would only read the LaRousse Gastronomique to make me and my brother laugh, because to us, what the French ate was just, you know, growing up on Finder's crispy pancakes and tomato soup, when my dad's there like, gizzards of duck. You know, I don't think what's a gizzard? I'm just, you know. So that was it. And so I didn't really have to say the least, have a literary kind of background. But in my bachelor's degree, so I originally started studying commercial illustration. You know, it was all about, it was quite the thing at the time. This is about 88, I suppose. Yeah, 88. You know, there's a lot of money in it. There was a lot, you know, we didn't even use computers when I was studying commercial illustration. They weren't a thing.
And yet it looked like, this is that weird moment where it looked like computers. It's like, it's as if they were, the graphic design of that era, it wasn't yet made on computers, but it was the style, it looks like it's computery. It's like they were sort of embracing that aesthetic before it became the real thing.
Yeah, predicting it. Yeah, that's a great call. But when I got onto my bachelor's degree, which was in contemporary art, I got so much into theory and writing and reading more than I ever had. I had one of those mentor tutors that you just dream about, who took a real interest in me, pushed me, really, really pushed me. Didn't let me get away with anything either.
That's what you need at that age.
He really impressed me. You know, he rocked up at that art school, and compared to all the other tutors, it was like, wow, this bloke's serious. And he was like, if you want to be an artist, he said, you've got to be like an architect. An architect studies for 7 years and can build a building that can serve like 20 businesses. And he knows about, you know, every aspect of it. And he's an expert. Now, if you want to be an artist, you can't just paint. You can't just do a performance. You've got to be an expert. You've got to be separate from the normal person. And no one had ever said that to me before. I just thought it was, you know, I'm an artist. You know, I think this is good. And I think, and, you know, I hear artists today say it when they have an exhibition or something, and they say something like, you know, I'm interested in shape and form, and I'm like, I don't give a fuck what you're interested in, really. I mean, I'm interested in my breakfast. It's like that. It's not enough for me, that. Anyway, so my final piece of work on my art degree was actually a written work. I said to my tutor, I said, I'm done with making art. I said, because what I've learned is, unless you can talk about it, and they taught us that, there was a whole module, ways of talking about the arts. And I said, without that, it's kind of meaningless. It's almost like you have the object or the installation or the painting, whatever form it takes, even a piece of music. But it doesn't have much to do with discourse until spoken or written language gets involved. You know, that's certainly how I felt at the time. And I said, so my final piece is a written work, and not an essay either. It's quite cringe, actually. I'm sure many of you, I'm sure you will know the French kind of pop philosopher Jean Baudrillard. Very successful, one of the most beautiful books of it. I love it to this day. It's called Cool Memories. it was like that. It was just aphorisms. You know, I just wrote a load of aphorisms, and I've still got a copy somewhere. When I read it, it's awful. It's awful. You know, I was 18. It's as awful as my poetry to my girlfriends was at the time. Actually, it's worse, because you're allowed to write angsty poetry at that age. You're not allowed to think you're Hegel. That's just not on the cards. So
yeah.
I'd given up all that art lark. And then, because then I'd done, I started a master's degree, and I was only 22. And I was growing weed, indoor weed growing, to pay for my course. And so I had to, again, the internet, it was just, you know, internet cafes, Leeds University had a couple of, you know, if you had to put your name on a calendar and you might get 30 minutes in 2 months or something. So I subscribed to High Times magazine, which is still going today, miraculously. And I wrote an article for them. I wrote a very cheesy article for them. Didn't know anything about how this works. I just wrote an article. This sounds what, more like that.
What year was this?
So this would have been around 93, I'd guess, 1993.
Right, that's what I thought, 93, 94, just immediately before the internet became ubiquitous.
Yeah, it might have been a bit later than that, maybe 94 or something. Yeah, because I took a year out, so likely then. And I sent this article off to their address in New York, and it was the first ever bit of writing I'd sent off. And by this time, I'd already sort of started reading about becoming a writer, and the writer's and artist yearbook was the thing to get, and it told you all the ages. You know. And it said, you know, be prepared for hundreds of rejections. And the first thing I was sent off, 2 weeks later, I got a letter with a contract and a check for £50. £50. And I had to sign the writers off. And I was like, I'm a professional writer. I am. I've just done what it takes. And that's when I wrote that novel after that, because someone made the mistake of telling me I could do it, and I went for it.
See, it's that thing where you get a break and you realize, oh, I actually can do this thing, which previously, just 10 seconds ago, seemed impossible. But actually, literally, I can't. It's like stepping over a threshold.
Well, there's a for anyone who's writing, especially if you're writing screenplays or stage plays, there's a great YouTube channel called Film Courage. And I contacted them. There's another story, actually, I can tell you about that channel later. But we were going to do this thing. I said to them, look, I said, why don't you? I said, most of the people who watch your channel are failed writers. You know, that's why they're watching it. They're trying to get advice from the successful writers you have on, who are giving out advice how to get into the industry, how to publish books, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, you know, I've been at this for years, and I've been dining out on crumbs. You know, I still think of that High Times article. And it's like, no, you are a writer. And you sold 10,000 copies of your first novel. And then there's this massive bit in between where I was a successful stand-up, so I did have some raconteur chops, and people were happy to pay for it to sell out Edinburgh shows. But, you know, then you look at successful writers, and it's just a completely different league, and it really does bring you down to earth a little bit when, you know, you look at the numbers, they're shifting. And, you know, I do see literature as sacred and more than shifting units. But I need to eat. I need to put a roof over my head. And so I do actually need to sell books. It's not like just I can give them away or anything. And I said to them, I said, I think it would make a great I was trying to publicise my novel, without a doubt. And they knew that. They're not idiots. But I said, I think it would be a good video. I could tell you my story. and the crumbs I've been dining out on and what keeps you going as a writer who's not kind of successful. And she got back to me and it was like, yeah, we'll do it. And she said, I can't remember exactly the road, but she said, can you meet us in LA on Thursday? And I thought, well, this kind of sums up my story. I can't get into America. I've got too much previous. And it was like, So that would have happened had I. And then I said to her, look, I said, this is the sort of thing I'm talking about. I said, I can make it convincingly look like you. And that they didn't buy it. They wanted it. You know, they wanted me in their studio. So
I'm surprised they didn't want you more when you told them that you couldn't get into America. I'm surprised that they didn't sort of find that glamorous and impressive.
Well, I actually thought that. I thought it added to the sort of aura of the whole sort of, these are the sort of stepping stones you've kind of got to deal with. But that might still happen because they had a bloke on their channel. He's a literary fiction teacher. He teaches people. I don't think you can actually teach people to be great writers. I think you can improve them, but I don't think you can. It's something you've grown up, you know, regardless of whether it's a conscious decision or not. It's a way of interpreting the world that you've grown up with and a need to somehow distill it, delimit it and present it. And if that isn't a passion and the passion is wanting to be a writer, they're two very different things. Anyway,
yeah.
So his name is Jack Grapes, and he made a video. He calls it method writing, which is a bit nasty, but you get the idea. It's like method acting, method writing. And they had him on their channel, and there's a bit. One of the things he teaches, I think, is called the transformative line. And she says to him, so what's the transformative line in this interview with him? And he says, well, it's a line that transforms the character, you know, profoundly. And she says, can you explain more? He says, well, we can do it. This is going somewhere, by the way. He says, well, we can do it. And she says, all right. He says, give me an I statement. So she says something like, I haven't been going out much because of COVID. And he says, right, drop the COVID. So, you know, just I haven't been going out much. And she says, all right, I haven't been going out much. He says, what's the deeper truth? And she really struggles with it. But he keeps saying, what's the deeper truth? And there's this really another little trick he uses, the other side of the same coin. It's not the opposite. So an example of that would be like, I don't know who I am, but the other side of the same coin would be, I do know what I'm not. And that will come in, that will make sense in a while. Anyway, he keeps using these little tricks to get her to go to the deeper thought, the deeper thought, the deeper thought. Because if she was writing and she wanted to start writing a piece, you know, I haven't been going out much since COVID. It's not the greatest opener. Let's, you know, if you want to be a writer, if you want to be an expert, if you want people to read your book and feel it, you know, you can't, I haven't been going out much. And in the end, he gets her to say, I'm stuck. And she goes, oh, you hear it. You hear it come from deep down inside her, the pain. And he says, there you go, we got there. And you don't see her because she's behind the camera, but she's crying. He said, we should have the camera on you now. He says, because this is what it's about. He says, because if you can write from where you are now, this is what people will pay for. These are the stories that people will say to their friends, you've got to read this. You've got to read this. And I put a new short up on my Substack once a month when it's going well, but when I was writing that, I didn't, because I was working all day. I was writing all night, 4 hours sleep, zombieing around the place. I was doing live lockpicking events for some of the biggest companies in the world, all NDAs, but you've all probably used them today. I'm talking about that size company, you know, team events where I'm sort of having to, and it was like doing stand up again, and it was nervous. And you know, you can teach someone to pick locks in 15 minutes. The rest of it is anecdotes, entertainment. But I was like a zombie, like, hello. I was late for one. You know, you can't be late. We were charging these people an absolute fortune because they can afford it. And I thought, right, I'm going to, this was before I'd written that novel, before I'd even thought about it. You know, any work on my novel was on this big 800-page one. I thought, I'm going to write a short story. I thought, I'd just written a piece about a couple of kids sitting in a shed. You know, I'd done so much stuff about my drug problems and all that. And the punters love that stuff. But okay, you know, you've heard it enough times now. And I wanted to do something totally unrelated to all that. So, you know, that sort of those first glimmers of desire and well, seduction's the wrong word, I think, but, you know, desire and warmth and friendship and all that. And I remember when I was about 13, I used to go and see this girl, and we weren't allowed in the house because it was chaos. It was alcohol chaos. And so when I went round there, we'd sit in the shed and nothing happened. It wasn't horrible, but it was really sweet. It was just nice. She obviously appreciated me being there. I appreciated being there, and we'd sit for an hour not doing much. Hey, you're a Scotsman, aren't you? Do you remember the Bruins? I may have pronounced that terribly.
Yeah, bad. The Bruins. It was a comic strip, comic book.
That's it. She had one of them. It had like a black and yellow tartan cover. And we used to read that. And, yeah, just, you know, these beautiful little things that happen when you're that age. And very innocent. Where I grew up wasn't an innocent place. You know, it was quite unpleasant and brutal in many ways. And I thought, so I wrote a story about that. And then I thought, do something else like that. So I thought, I'll tell you what, I'll write a short story when I was 14. And I thought, where shall I start? And I thought, I'll just do a transformative line. I'll just use that trick just to get it going. And that's what that novel is. It started out as a short story and I just didn't stop writing. And it's 258 pages. Yeah. So it sort of came out of nowhere as well. It started as a short story. But anyone who does write or enjoys writing, check out Jack Grapes. You can find it on Film Courage. The whole interview is definitely worth watching. But that they've also edited just that transformational line bit. But I made a YouTube video about it. Well, I made a video about it saying how amazing this is and how useful it is. And Jack Grapes contacted me. He said, can we use your video? I was like, yep. And that, you know, that goes on the pile with the High Times, you know, the contract from High Times, you know, another little bit of, you know, so not
and social trophy.
Yeah social proof, yeah. We could call it.
What was the transformative line that started your novel?
I knew you were going to ask that. Well, I actually gave it away. I got to that bit. I mean, I didn't need to get to a deeper, deeper, deeper thought because the narrator's 14 years old. So it didn't need to be that deep. But I didn't know who I was because 14-year-olds, you know, it's a flailing sort of grasping for identity, but I knew what I wasn't. I wasn't the popular kid. I wasn't the hard kids. I wasn't the gypsies. I wasn't, you know, I could identify the other. I know a bit of you thought, yep, is an art college. He went to art college. He identified the other. But I certainly did. So I just thought I'd work from there. Really interesting, well, for me, and hopefully some people watching, initially I thought this is kind of awkward how easy I'm finding it to write from a 14-year-old's perspective. You know, I've been trying to develop my voice for 35 years of writing, and going back to age 14, limited vocabulary, total unreliable narrator, you know, pushed to the max. You know, you just don't, a 14-year-old me doesn't know what I know today, obviously. And it was actually quite easy. I was thinking, oh, this isn't a good sign, man. I can write like a kid. Well done. But that actually flipped. It flipped when the story arc started appearing. Because when there's, you know, when there's effect and consequence, it's easy to have a 14-year-old sort of laugh at his dad saying goose gizzards or whatever. But when you catch your mum trying to look sexy, and my mother wasn't an attractive woman, it just wasn't. And it was heartbreaking at 14. And to write that response, you know, I sort of, I don't want to give too much away from the book, but yeah, it was emotional writing. And you know, I think it was the French psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan who said, "What I write takes me by surprise and teaches me what I think." And it was like that with this. And as I was writing it, I was thinking, that's a lot for a 14-year-old. You know, there's a lot of children, you know, neglected, abused in many, in all the forms possible. Sort of, I'm not taking anything away from the effect there, but obvious forms of damage and obvious forms of potential life-changing trauma. But there's also those very subtle things that you just sort of take in your step that I think almost happen on a daily basis when you're, 13, 14, 15. You know, I was a late developer. I had no pubic hair, and I sat next to a bloke in English who had a fucking beard. And, you know your dad's got a pile of magazines under the bed with these angels in it. And yet your mother is like a fishwife, you know, she's like, that's who she is. And I'm like, hang on, but why did he marry her if he likes really sexy women? Because there's loads of really sexy women. You know, there was a brothel on my street. I didn't know it at the time, but, you know, there were very, very sexy young ladies hanging out outside it. I couldn't work it out. And I felt really sorry for my mum. I felt really sad for her for years. And I didn't realise that until I wrote it, until I wrote that book. And that sort of stuff catches you out. And you've got to have the balls to include that, because otherwise it's not worth putting out there, is it? Like there's a quote. Is a quote, it's often misquoted to Goethe. I can't remember who actually said it, maybe John Eden or someone. But in that film Courage interview, she gets to a bit where she says, I was lied to about who I was. And she says, look, I don't want to say what actually happened because some of them might watch this and I'll get in trouble. And he says to her, writers do get in trouble. Writers deal in trouble. Words to that effect. And he says, and he quotes it as Goethe. It doesn't really matter. It's the sentiment, not who said it. But he said, be brave, be bold, and great powers from on high will protect you. And it's a nice idea, but this morning when I got a WhatsApp message from my brother with a photo of this. I was so like, yay. And then my mum's friend, who's in it, said, I bought your novel yesterday. I'm like, oh, and I had all this with the first novel as well. Like, my mum never admitted to reading it, but friends of hers told me things that let me know that she had read it. And she never, my mum never said anything nice to me. She really didn't. She wasn't an horrible woman, but her parents were alcoholics, so she didn't know how to. She was never taught how to be nice. She made terrible food and was... but she was also a hero in many ways, which is sometimes often the way. But there's bits in that first novel that just... You know, because I was immature as a writer, I was immature intellectually, you know, I was 23 or whatever, but I thought I knew everything. I thought, you know, I'm 23, I know, of course I know, I've got a master's degree, I know everything. And just sort of dishing out these things about some really grotesque stuff. And I didn't even consider the thought of people I knew reading it. Until it was too late, and yet you have to do that. You have to do that, and even if you're writing about swords and wizards and or whatever, I think all literature is autobiographical in a way. And
I'm thinking about my own output, especially my early videos, where I was very candid and honest. And I made the same mistake that you made, where, well, there are two mistakes. The first is that people who see your videos or read your book aren't going to use this stuff against you. They will. And the second is the people in your real life who already know about you and they know you IRL, they might see this. They might see this video. They might read this book. So your real life might collide with this one, and this one might attack you. It's the two dangers here. And I think it's the same in, you know, your YouTube videos as in writing a novel. I think it's these two dangers are still there. It's the danger of being honest. It's the danger of revealing too much. There's even a name for it. Oh, yeah, oversharing. I think it's true. I think I am guilty of that.
Likewise, but I am happy to. I mean, I do have a private life. I maintain a private life. But the world needs characters who are happy to put the truth out there, because without it, it's just not good for culture. It's not good for civilization, because it, you know, literature, well, let's just say storytelling, it shows the effects of what happens to people within systems. This is
absolutely like that woman you mentioned. If she had stuck on the first line, I've not gone out much since COVID, that's true, but it's superficial. And it's also circumstantial. It's locked in the here and now. It's about COVID. It's about the lockdowns and so on. It's not touching on a profound truth. And you could read that book that would derive from her first sentence. I'm not going out much since COVID. And you might recognize it, but it wouldn't be, and you know, connect it with your own life, but it wouldn't be profound.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a glut of that sort of work out there. And you know, it's like, they're not really the ones that maintain a place in discourse. Look at 1984. Look, you know, I struggle with the idea of masterpieces, whether it be any form. But there are some novels that just really, let's get to the deeper truth. What's the deeper truth? And when you do that, that's how you stumble upon things like Newspeak. And that's how you stumble upon things that, otherwise, unless you've put the work in, we wouldn't know about them. And I think they're weapons to an extent. And with this novel, you know, I was trying to think as I was writing it, and as the story arc started taking shape, I sort of thought, you know, what is the function of this? And, you know, my art teacher said to me once, I've got a blinder for you after this. I will lighten up a bit, people. But my A-level art teacher, he was like a mentor as well, but I was too young really to understand the sort of implications of it and how lucky I was. But he said to me once, well, he actually said it when he awarded me the art prize at school, and all the teachers hated me at school. I was only really good at art. And he was giving out, it was a prize night at the school. Ah, it's in the novel. I'm just telling you stories. Well, basically, he said, artists bring people together. They connect people. In a culture that seeks to push people apart, artists bring people together. And I thought, yeah, that's what the social function is. That's what this is about. This is. You know, I think it sounds like a leap, but it's absolutely connected to that, to what I just said. Mothers naturally, you know, I mean naturally, shame young men about sexuality. I think it's part of the natural order of things. I Lord knows why. I've tried to work it out. And, you know, I remember going around to some girl's house when I was about 11 and I had my first French kiss. And when I got home, I was so excited. My mum was like, oh, you're happy? Why are you so happy? And I went, I spent 20 minutes French kissing Sarah Butterfield. And my mum's face just, you know, she looked like the devil. And she went, you're too young for all that. And it hurt, man. It shamed me. Absolutely shamed. And then I'm then dealing with this. On the one hand, it was like the most amazing thing that had happened in my sort of 10 years of living, and yet one of the two most important people in my life was aggressively appalled by it. And I think a lot of not actually what happens in the book, but I think a lot of people will, and a lot of the reviews that have come through have said this, you know, I remember those feelings. I remember those kinds of confusions and that we deal with. And if these things aren't documented in the future, marketing will dominate our historical culture. You know, there'll be books in the future full of adverts. And it'll be like, this is how we lived in 1986. And it'll be like McDonald's adverts. But it is the denouement that people can calm down a little bit. I managed to find that art tutor because he was so influential. In a school where the tutors hated me, they tried to chuck me out, they tried to expel me all the time. And I managed to hang on, and I stayed on for 1 year in the sixth form because I needed to do A-level art. And they said, you can't just do A-level art. You've got to do this, 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 and this. And I'd been chucked out of all those classes before Christmas. So I was only doing, no, tell a lie, I was doing A-level art and pottery. it was excellent, mate, absolutely brilliant. But I managed to find him. Mr. Sparks, his name was. And this was only about 6 months ago, 7 months ago. I found that he was curating. I found online a man called Mr. Sparks, or no, Roy Sparks, which was his name. And he'd curated for a museum in Strood, which is near Chatham, one of the Medway towns, sort of in between Chatham and Medway and North Kent and southeast London. And I thought, it's got to be him. It's got to be him. And so I contacted the museum and I said, it says that Roy Sparks, blah, blah, blah. And she said, well, that was a long time ago. She said, I can give you his phone number, though. And I was like, oh, yeah, yeah, that'd be amazing, which I thought was pretty bad of her. Really, here's his personal phone. I called him up. I went, and this really old man, I mean, he must be in his 90s. He was old in 1986, you know. He was like, hello? I went, is that Roy Sparks? He went, speaking? I said, did you work at the Downs? Yeah, it was called that. Did you work at the Downs Comprehensive School? He went, yes, that's right. I went, it's Chris Dangerfield. He didn't have a clue who I was. Did not have a clue.
Oh, he's and not on YouTube.
I thought with my, you know, a standout surname and I, you know, the sort of the relationship I certainly felt we had, and it probably down to age, but it was, I'll tell you what, it was actually nice because I said, well, look, that doesn't matter. You set me on a course that if someone at that time hadn't, because my dad had died just that same year, and I was going off the rails, you know, really going off the rails. And I said, if you weren't where you were and if you hadn't have said the things and encouraged me, I think things would have been very different, and I've thoroughly enjoyed my life. So thank you. And he was like, that's wonderful. But I started getting the feeling that he was then forgetting who he was talking to, so I sort of just went, anyway, I'll see you around. Yeah, bit of an hard one to take, but yeah.
Amazing. See, yeah, I often wonder about this, getting in touch with old teachers, and you never know, are they going to remember you? And I did actually, I got in touch with one of them, and he had no idea who that was. He was in his early 90s. Yeah.
Did you think, but, you thought he would? You thought he would know you?
Yeah, I did, just for various reasons. I thought surely he'll remember the family, if not me specifically. But no, he didn't. He had no, or at least he claimed he had no idea. But anyway, I'm certain other teachers would have remembered me, but him, I, you know.
If you think about it, though, I mean, that fella must have been teaching at my school or teaching art at schools for 40 years. Think how many students that is.
And exactly. Thousands.
Yeah. Yeah. And probably hundreds of thousands. I mean, if anyone's got a calculator handy. But, you know, I doubt I was the only person he chose to encourage. I was in a class of 25, 30 people, so I felt like, you know, the sort of the standout student in A-level art, but he had another few hundred thousand people, and yeah. But yeah, it was still nice to thank him, and he was grateful, so it was worth it. Yeah.
It does feel like something you should do. To thank them, because I think teachers especially, they don't often get thanked, and they don't often get thanked by their students as adults. That cannot happen very many times at all for each teacher. So I think it's important, if you know people watching, if you do remember a teacher fondly, then try to track them down and thank them for what they did. I think it's a good idea. But to get back to the novel, so we've obviously said a lot about it, so I'm going to ask a sort of basic question here. How autobiographical is it? Because you, and how much did you deviate from the reality? Because you said when the story arc began to emerge, is that the story of what actually happened, or is it a fictitious story arc?
I think all stories are exaggerated. I mean, humans communicate via stories, don't they? You bump into someone in the street, friend of your mother's or friend of yours or an old teacher, and it's like, how are you? I'm good. How are you? And 9 times out of 10, the next question is, what's been happening? What's that effect? And then a story will start. Oh, I'll tell you what's been happening. I'm doing this construction job over on so-and-so. And then a story evolves. Now, it's not, you're not trying to deceive, you're not trying to lie, although people do that as well, but not really in those situations. But because they weren't there, you feel a certain amount of exaggeration is allowed just so that they feel it like you did. I think there's an element of that in all storytelling.
So that they get the idea.
Yeah, if you're in a fight in a boozer, when you tell the story, you ramp it up a bit because when you're there, you're full of adrenaline and it's all going. Whereas what actually happened was someone headbutted you, you fell over, he jumped on top of you and someone smashed a glass on his head. But if you say that, your mates can go, oh, that's not the best Friday night out, is it? So you go, oh, man, and he smashed and it was claret everywhere. And I was like, hey, what's going on here? And then, you know, the bird I was after, she's left. So you sort of... So the story is, I mean, it says in the front, presented as a work of fiction, which I nicked off of Bukowski. That's what he puts in the front of his books. It's a way of saying this is a true story without implicating yourself in court. But check this out. When I was writing it, just use the real people's names because I'm not going to be able to keep track of names I don't recognize. So just use real people's names, and then when you've finished it, you can do an easy, I use Scrivener to write manuscripts. So you can do an easy find and replace and change all the names. And I've given it to my formatter, a bloke called, he's a subscriber of mine, he's a writer, he's got a Substack. If you like fantasy, I said I'd give him a shout out because he formatted it for me. I could have got someone on Fiverr to format it. I could have got a professional formatter. Problem is, every time I talk to them, it's another 20 quid. And I was WhatsApping him every 10 minutes, you know, how'd you do this? How'd you do this? What's this? And then he showed me how to do the full uploading process. It's just an absolute dream. If you like fantasy, you know, swords and all that, he's got about 10 novels on Amazon and he's got loads on his Substack. Illuminatus is what he's called on Substack. Good writer. Check him out. Decent bloke. Why did I deviate down there exaggerating? Oh, yeah. So I'd given it to him to format, and I thought, oh, fuck, I haven't changed all the names. And I changed, I said, he'd already formatted it, and I said, listen, I've got to change a load of names. As I was changing them, and just for the fun of it, I used some of my other friends' real names as characters, just so that when they read it, it's a bit funny that, oh, come on. Thanks. And I've done that in my other novel. But there are a couple of people in it, and this is petty as hell, but there was a kid at school who was very unpleasant to me. And how can I explain this without giving it away? Let's imagine his real name is Peter Bones. In the novel, it's Pete Jones, but it's actually more obviously him. And about 3 days after the book had been available, he signed up to my Substack. And going back to that Be Brave, Be Bold, a lot of it is about the families on my street. You know, the real names, like the Johnsons, the Downings, the Altons, the Mahonings, the Gardeners. And there was one of them murdered and raped someone, went to prison 30 years, only got out a couple of years ago. And I mentioned that and talked about it. And I did change their names, but everyone's going to know it's them. And they may well contact me saying, why did you feel the need to dig all that up again? And I'll have to answer that. Because it happened. No, I think someone else suffered a bit more. You know, and these are people I really liked, and they were really nice to me as well, really, really nice families. Even the bloke that done that, you know, I got on with him. But I know that four of the old ladies who are now old ladies have bought it. They've told me, they've WhatsApped me. And, you know, they're in touch with me on WhatsApp because my mum died a few years ago, 3 years ago. And so we all got on WhatsApp so that we could arrange funerals and probate and all that luck. And one of the women who's bought it, her husband's in it. And I went up, he used to be a lorry driver, and I went up to Birmingham from London when I was, I was about 14. And some of the things that happened on that journey that was sort of, you know, what happens in the lorry stays in the lorry, are in the book. And she's sent me a message today. It's ordered. And I'm like, but you can't seriously be an autobiographical writer and not write things because your mum's friends might get a little bit upset. That, you know, that's just not going to cut it, is it? That's my role. You get the rough with the smooth with these things.
Because to take something out, to not mention something, would, from your point of view, that would ruin the whole, that would distort the whole. Because from anyone else's point of view, they don't know that something was removed. They don't know that you're omitting something. So there's a dilemma. I mean, how much to include, how much to disclose?
Well, knowing where to draw the line is not drawing the line. If I'm explaining the street dynamic and families that were relevant to me and events that were relevant to me as a kid, when you're 14 years old and the bloke down the road whose bed you sleep in when they're having a party at their house suddenly gets arrested for what I previously said, that's massive. It's massive. The whole street was talking about it. That goes in. Of course, that goes in because it... You know, the book's called Love in the Time of Nudie Mags. It's about desire. It's about seduction. It's about sexuality. And that happens. You know, I think I'm worrying a little bit too much, actually. I think, thinking about it now, I'm being a little bit... they're adults, you know. They're adults. I mean, there's things more painful. Things are like, you know, there was one really hot woman who lived on our street, really hot. I mean, what I'd call hot, anyway. She looked like a nudie mag woman. That was essentially why I thought she was a hot woman, because that's what I'd been trained on. The first naked woman I ever saw was in a magazine, and you know that sort of imprinting had a massive effect on me that took decades to remove, and it's not totally gone, you know. But, you know, there's bits in it where I'll sort of say that, you know, at street parties and street barbecues, that we had a street club and my mum was on the committee, and, you know, they're always organising things, and at every barbecue or party in someone's house, everyone was shit-faced. And as soon as the men start drinking, they're all on this one bird, Janine. And they all, the more they drink, the less they think their wives know it. And I can only communicate the effect if I tell you the truth. And the truth was, all the other women looked knackered, looked malnourished, looked neglected by, you know, probably sexually, certainly in terms of being loved. You know, they were wrung out working class old women before their time. And when this sort of 24-year-old sort of, you know, looked like Kathy Lloyd, all her hair up on top, you know, the blokes
Dolly Bird.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can't say she was really hot, because what does that mean? It only means something when you say the rest of them weren't. They really weren't. And I've had to say that about my own mother. It's an odd set of quandaries.
Yeah, well, I mean, writing anything like this is a quandary. I actually wrote a huge essay this year about my mother because she died last September, like last year, and that was, you know, again and again, it was dilemmas like, should I include this? Should I include that? A lot of the things I didn't, because I thought this essay has a particular purpose, and there's no need to mention X, Y, and Z, because that would work against the purpose. And I might reveal those other things in a future essay, or I might not. I think I will. But for now, it's... and the thing is, there are still many people alive who knew her. And, yeah, I'm more nervous about this stuff than you are, I think, because I just don't want to ruffle feathers, because it's... because I've had experience of this, you know, I know that there are so many malicious people who will misinterpret and exaggerate, distort, exploit, take out of context anything that you see, anything that you reveal. But creatively, that essay had a certain purpose, so that I just included things that worked towards that with a bit of nuance. I mean, I didn't claim ridiculous or anything untrue, but it was fashioned for that purpose. It sounds like with your novel, it's not a particular purpose other than to give a sense of the whole truth. So you just included things, you included everything almost.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's an odd one, isn't it? Upon what criteria do you put something in? I could give you 20 examples of when I felt really sad for my mum in terms of female beauty and male desire and her lack of place within that space, but I didn't have to put them all in. I had to put enough in so that people knew. Now, whether I got that right or wrong, that's not for me to decide. You know, that'll be for the reader. But you don't need to stress the point. If you know, one or two examples to make a point is usually enough. One can't be, because there could be an anomaly. But if, okay, so I get it, there's that. Or at least the unreliable 14-year-old narrator thinks that, at least that.
Yeah.
You know, I've read novels that I know are true, and I've just thought, you know, shit, man. You know, wow. And I really respect that. I think it goes back to that expertise. If you want to separate yourself from people who can type, you've got to be brave. You've got to be bold. You've got to be prepared for what you say having consequences in the real world.
Well, that's the other side of what the Goethe quote, where if you are truthful, then great powers will protect you. I think that's true to an extent. I do think that's true, because I think the general public or your general readership or your general fan base will trust you to be honest, and they'll trust you to not mean harm. Regardless of what naysayer, your attackers, your enemies say and claim about what you've said, I think people will take it on trust. They'll give you the benefit of the doubt, most people, most of the time, because if they perceive that you are generally a good and honest and well-intentioned person, I think in that sense, yes, greater powers will protect you, that you can sort of rely on. Well, most people know that I'm not a piece of shit. So it's okay, it's safe to reveal X, Y, and Z, because it even if it's used against me by some misfits or enemies, it doesn't make much difference, if any. See, this is just something that I've thought about a lot because, well, because of the attention that my work has brought me from people who really would like me to just stop. And, you know, there are many people like me. I'm not claiming that I'm unique in this regard. Again, I've got to make that caveat, because if I don't, someone will claim, listen to them, claiming victimhood. Like, you've always got to qualify this stuff because someone will claim the worst about you. But yeah, I've had a lot of experience of this. So it's something that's on my mind. But honestly, with that essay about my mum, I ended up being like 99% of what I wanted to include, I did include. So
I think it shows strength. I think it shows emotional strength. Yeah. I mean, I've already had a couple of people attack me, like I do every year. What, you're going on Woz's thing again? Do you know that blah, blah? And I'm like, okay, I'll talk about that in another somewhere else. And I know that people would use things against you intentionally, looking for them, like fine tooth comb through any essay. Ah, Woz fault is mum, you know. And I won't get that because my YouTube channel, you know, I do have a private life, but I've said a hell of a lot of things that it does. It's quite difficult to shame me at this point. So.
Yeah, well, that's
I hope it is.
Yeah, that's a useful thing about revealing stuff. It means that, okay, that's out of the bag now. So it's done. So what are you going to do? You can't reveal that. I've done it. And people are bored hearing about it. So there's no point in you bringing it up. So fuck you. That's a good thing about revealing, oversharing. It means that, okay, it's out of the way now.
I had people attacking me for things I said on stage as a comedian, and that always blew my mind. And you know, have I really got to explain to you that it was an act? It was a performance. Yeah, there were some autobiographical bits in my stage show, but certain things I'd say just because they were funny and a bit naughty. And you're going to make a video about it. One of the weirdest things I ever had was when Laura Towler contacted me and said, look, I just need to ask you, did you have sex with a dog? I said, yeah, it's a no, it's a hard no, no. And she said, yeah, I just had to ask you.
Yeah. All right, I've got a similar thing because people think that I'm a bestialist because of something I said once, which, I mean, let's not get into it now, but I'm just noting that I've got a similar thing hanging over me. And it's absurd. It's just ridiculous. But yeah, to get back to the novel, because I want this to be about the novel, the 14-year-old narrator, I would have no idea how to do that because I cannot, maybe because I don't have kids, I don't see 14-year-olds in front of me. I don't know what they're like. There's nothing to refresh my memory of what I was like. And it gets very difficult for me anyway to remember what I was like. I can't even tell you, like, how do I differ now from how I was when I was 30 or 25. I have no idea. It's difficult.
What I found myself doing was processing the whatever I was thinking about and whatever I was writing about, processing it as me now. And then how would I have talked about that? How would I have reacted about that as 14? At the moment, it's like, yeah, happened, so B, but 14, A happened, so C, you know, because I don't have the words to describe it. I don't have the experience. I don't understand the context. It, as I said earlier, that got more challenging as the book went on because when the story arc, it feels like a montage. Well, montage. Because it's just that it's like sections. Some of them are like 5 lines long, 10 lines long, and I think people, when they start reading it, think it's going to be like that all the way through. But I felt, at least, and I can only go by my own thoughts, the quality of those sections, we could call them, was strong enough to maintain a novel that's, you know, only that thick, 250 pages. But story arcs do appear and they creep up on you. That's when that actually got difficult, because then it's long term consequences. Woes, I've really got to use the toilet. I'm an old man. Can I do that, please?
Yeah. Go ahead. I'll post the PO Box reminder first of all.
If you want to take part in the Christmas card stream, now is the last chance for your card to arrive in time. Don't delay.
And also there's the merchandise store, millennial.com/merch, which is an abbreviation that I don't like, but it's useful. And of course you can donate crypto, donate with money. There are various options, and you can find all of them at millennial.com. There's also the NFT this year. I don't have a specific advert for that, but let me see if I can find one that I put on the website. The NFT is available now. It wasn't at first, but it is now. And let's see, did I save this? Oh, yes, here we go. Oh, he's back, so we don't need to. But yes, check out the NFT. Welcome back, Chris.
Yeah, and people, I haven't been streaming for a while. If you're one of my supporters, support Millennial is excellent every year. And as a YouTuber, making one stream is a nightmare for me. It takes ages setting up, making thumbnails. Woes puts this on, what, about 4 different platforms? I struggle with just getting 6, it on YouTube. Yeah, the amount of time, effort, stress that goes into making this happen, I couldn't do it. Trust me. So
it's all true. Everything Chris just said is true. I've been working for the last 3 months to make all of this happen. So if you give something back, please do. That'd be much appreciated.
Sorry, I know this is awkward for you, but listen, people, even if it's only a couple of quid, if everyone watching this video gave £1, that is excellent. You know, people sometimes say to me, okay, so enough of that. But I think it needed saying, because I don't hear you say it.
Yeah, I don't know how to do it. I'm not good at that side of things. And of course, again, this is another aspect of it. As soon as I say something like this, other people will attack me as some sort of grifter, even though I've fucking put 3 months of work into this. But then they'll attack that as well. So as a public, see, honestly, don't become an e-celeb unless you've got a very thick skin, because you'll need it. There was something else I was going to say about that. Oh, yeah, Substack. If you want to support me, the best way is by subscribing to my Substack and getting behind the paywall, because that's then my income throughout the year, so that would be much appreciated indeed. And of course you can send super chats. Somebody's just sent one on Rumble. Let's do the super chats actually, and then I'll ask you to summarize the novel just to tempt people to buy it. Dawn said, wait, Chris wrote a book. Love to all the scrubs. That's Dawn Browning. I think you are familiar with her. Yeah.
The joke there is I started writing the other novel about 9 years ago, and I honestly thought it would be out that Christmas. I started writing it in about February, and I'd say the scrubs of my community on my YouTube channel, it's a long story. But I just mispronounced subs once. But I'd be like, it's coming out in December, and then it'd be, it's coming out in January, and then the next year, and the next year, and the next year. So when this actually come out, people were like, no way, you've actually done it. And I'd be like, no, it's a different novel.
This is the 800-page book that you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's still being worked this on. Is why it's a bad idea to announce anything until it's 95 to 99% ready, or even better, 100% ready. Because if you do that before, then stage fright kicks in, people's expectations kick in, they start asking you, when's it going to be done? And yeah, another piece of advice there for any budding e-celebs. So that's Dawn. And Dawn Browning is actually going to be on Millennial this year in the memorial stream to talk about Lady of Shalott. And then Mr. Lott said, let's go. Thank you very much. Justin Foster said, last year you two talked about using AI to make nationalist films. That was actually not last year. It was, I think it was 2023. Yeah. The technology AI has advanced dramatically since then. Perhaps it's time for a film about Rotherham. I don't know if you've seen The Magdalene Sisters, but it seems like a good model for the narrative structure. There actually is an AI film about Rotherham. I can't remember what it's called now, but I saw it advertised on Twitter just about a week ago. Someone has done it, and it looks like it's quite well done. I wrote, Chris, I wrote a series of essays this year. Well, actually, I started them a long time, like a year and a half ago. But I wrote a series about AI image creation, imaging, called Future Magic. And I don't know if I linked them to you. I don't know if I made you aware of that series. But it's a series of essays where I mull over this, the matter of AI imaging and using AI to create art as opposed to creating slop. And just sort of entertainment. Can it be used to create actual art? Now, you and I don't need to go into that now because that's a whole topic, whole tangent. But the Super Chat is about that. The technology has advanced dramatically since you and I were talking about it. I would actually dispute that. I think that the very, very rapid change happened in that first year, in like 2023. I do think it's advanced since then, and I'm, you know, it's going to keep advancing, and it is going to, yes, it's going, it already is dominating YouTube and Twitter and Facebook. You see these crazy videos that people make of like an elephant turning into a light bulb, which transforms into the, you know, whatever, crazy stuff. I do think it's going to be useful, and, but just briefly, Chris, what would you say about AI imaging?
I think I'm waiting for voice to video. I'm waiting to be able to sit in front of a monitor with a microphone, with a screenplay that I've written, and say, right, it's interior, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, middle class house in Slough or something like that, and it starts building it, and then I say more 70s, and then it starts changing it. I say, yep, so the location's sorted. There's two blokes wearing, you know, sort of looks like they just come out of prison suits, sitting on a sofa on the left, and it starts forming it, and you're it's voice to video. You're making a movie without a crew. That without a doubt, that technology already exists. It just hasn't been released to us yet, you know. That I think that's going to be incredible. I think a lot of the concern about AI will be much like the concern about cameras. I know on the dissident right, modernism is frowned upon, but I think the invention and the availability of cameras saved art, if anything. I think the response to being able to take photos and get them developed at a fairly cheap price gave us modernism, gave us Picasso's Guernica, gave us Paul Klee, gave us Andy Warhol. Andy Warhol was screen printing Marilyn Monroe pictures. It's incredible. I it's almost like a moral panic. And yet, at the same time, I think it's a significant, I think it is an industrial revolution. Nothing's undeniable, but you're going to have some argument to say that it's not an industrial revolution. The business, my business that I've just left to do writing and YouTube full time, within the space of about 6 months, AI was involved in pretty much everything. Everything. Like, it used to take me about 5 hours to put a mail shop together, you know, just send out to all our mailing list where these products have got a 50% discount, you know, import images, crop images, turn images. And then we got, it was half price, my email marketing software, AI based, and I could make an email infinitely better in about 45 minutes. Subject lines based on, you know, 20 years of data, tested data. So instead of me there going, is 50% better than half price? I can A/B test it. But with AI, you know, remember, this is a large language model. It's done the testing. You don't need to A/B test anymore. If I put in 50% off flash sale, and then the AI says half price sale, quickest pickers win, that's based on test. That's based on things that have happened already. And that's and the conversions confirmed it as well. You know, it wasn't
just,
this is easy.
Yeah, and the thing is, I know a lot of people will be objecting to that and saying that it's just sloppifying everything. But that is going to happen. And so if everyone else is doing it, then I really don't know what the correct response to this is. Because to say, well, I'm just not going to do it, I'm going to have the moral high ground. Yeah, but then you're going to be replaced. I mean, you're going to die out. You're going to be outcompeted. Yeah. I understand both sides. I think I understand both sides and even feel both sides. I think I get it, but the aversion to it all. But I think the answer is, as you said, and what AI, what a real artist will want from AI is the ability to be very specific and to keep sculpting in the way that a sculptor molds a piece of clay, yes, to keep sculpting a scene until it is what was in his head. And AI can't do that yet. It can't facilitate that. Just now, you put in a prompt and then you've just got to accept pretty much what it gives you. Or you can try the prompt 10 times over and choose the one that best matches what you wanted. It's not, I think it's a real stretch to call that art at this point. But I think it will come. And I think that you should be careful about just saying no.
We went from the Renaissance, you know, these like, or like Caravaggio or someone, Rembrandt, all these, you know, and then Man Ray. Man Ray was a photographer. He used technology to make art. And it's considered art. Man Ray is considered one of the 20th century's greatest artists. He's a photographer. Andy Warhol, whether you like him or not, he got students to make screen prints of images other people made and deliberately offset them so they looked garish and incorrect. The beauty of Andy Warhol is what it says about that period in the 20th century. And that, I think for me, that's the function of art. That because if we don't have that, the people that what the future will know about the late 60s is what the corporations want them to know about the late 60s. It's like a state of pure revisionism. Whereas you can't get rid of Andy Warhol. Well, you can, but it's going to be that's a lot of work. And actually, whatever people who've got agendas, whatever they want to tell you, the fact is, the most successful, famous, popular artist in the late 60s was a bloke who was not paying students to make screen prints. That happened.
Yeah. Yeah, it's something that I think we're going to have to adapt to, and it's going to have to be nuanced. I think that total embrace of it would be unwise, but total rejection of it would also be unwise. Okay. Patrick says, I bought 12,000 copies of the book on Amazon, thinking it was a nudie mag. Sorry, Pat. And then John Palmer just gives $5. Thank you very much.
Nice one, JP.
Yeah. Okay, so let's wrap up now, and I'll ask you to summarize the novel, the new one, quite briefly, just for the sake of giving people a notion of, you know, why they should want to read it.
Okay, I haven't done this before, but I think I can do it now. Well, broadly, it's being 14 in 1986. It's the things that most 14-year-old boys are going to be tackling. That weird place where you think you're moving into manhood, you want to move into manhood, and yet you're actually half a decade away. But that's the goal. But the story, I think, if I had to summarize it, was a child coming to terms with the difference between representation and reality.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, that would do. Actually, that's fine.
Yeah, I think that's a good sum. Precy, out of interest, just one last question. I find that writing the essay about my mother helped to clarify some things for me. It helped me to make sense of some things. Did you have that experience writing this?
Yeah, I said it earlier on. It was heartbreaking. In many places, it was heartbreaking. I learned a lot about myself. And like that Lacan quote, I think it's Lacan, what I write takes me by surprise and teaches me what I think. And it took me back to a place where I didn't have the ability to think about these things at the depth I can now, the implications of them, the profound effect they've had on me to the present day. And, I was weeping like a little girl while I was writing some of that book. I was laughing as well. It's not just melancholia and it's self-indulgence, but your parents, both my parents are dead, and the relationship I have with the memory of my parents has changed through writing that book, which was never my intention. Like I said, I set out to write a short story just about a 14-year-old, and now I've got a very different relationship with the memory of the two people that brought me into this world. And that hasn't stopped. So it's not like, oh, now that's different. That fallout is still going on a daily basis, obviously, because these are huge things.
Yeah. It's a funny experience. I've had it as well with fiction and non-fiction, where you're writing something and it develops this. Either you realize, okay, I've got to make this much bigger than it is. It's not a short story, isn't enough. Or you're writing something and some tangent emerges and then that becomes its own thing. And you've got, okay, that's going to be a separate essay. I'll take this stuff out and so that it can breathe and have the life that it needs. It's a funny thing with writing. It often has these unexpected offshoots.
That's what that 800-page novel is. I don't know if you've read David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest, but incredible, incredible book. He was asked in an interview whether it was structured like fractals. So he's got his main movement, and then there's these five sort of bits that come off that, but then five come off of them, and then... He said it was, but I feel like he said that in retrospect. It was like, actually, I'll go with that. But in my currently 800-page novel, I decided not to edit myself. So if I'm writing and then I think, oh, actually, you know, there's that story. And then while I'm talking, so I've got to go, very quick example. So there's a bit, it's not a drug story. I don't want people to think it's a drug story. It's actually about someone getting off drugs. And so it's not a load of drug stories. But an important part was when I first tried heroin. And so I'm in a boozer in Soho in the French House, and the woman behind the jump, the landlady, Leslie, lovely lady, she says to someone, she says, well, everyone, I don't know why they don't just go around to Wardour Street Park. Everyone knows you can buy heroin there. Coat on, tenner across the bar, finish McGuinness, and I'm walking around there. But as in my head, I'm walking around there, I walk past the Admiral Duncan, and I was in the French House when the Admiral Duncan blew up. And so I tell that story. And we were in the French House. It just went boom. All the windows of the French House went through. Everyone's screaming. Everyone's trying to get out. Me and my mate, quick, let's get downstairs so we can have a quick line before we get chucked out. You know, just ridiculous. And then when I go down into the toilet with that bloke, I thought, actually, he's had an amazing effect. He had such a significant effect on me. So then I start talking about him and when he took me to Venezuela to get me clean once and what happened in Venezuela. We nearly got sent to prison at Venezuela. And I whereas with a commercially viable, pretty much sort of, not a hero's journey, but there's like Freytag's triangles and traditional story structures in there. With the other one, no. If you think that, say it. But the trick is to be able to, hang on a minute, right, Weverell, that's his name, French House toilets, the Admiral Duncan blew up, oh yeah, I'm walking round to Wardour Street. You've got to get back, because otherwise it's a book of loose ends, and that's like an anti-novel, isn't it? You want a book of tied up ends. That's
yes, the trick. Of course. Yeah, and it sounds like that's what time in the... Love in the Time of Needy Mags is. Sounds like it's more tidy. Like yeah, there's an arc.
Yeah, without a doubt. Yeah. I mean, they creep up on you. They creep up. And that was important. I didn't want it. There was a... I've got to go. If you ask me about my book, I'll talk forever. Sorry.
It's a famous thing. If you ask a writer about his work, he'll talk and talk, because there is so much to say about it. But anyway, let's end it here, because this has been lovely, and I think we've learned a lot. I hope people do hold up the book one more time, like they do in American adverts, like for this. Yeah, there we go. Thank you.
Yeah, Will Self said, and I, as much as I know people think that Will Self's a bit left, he's actually a very interesting person. He's been very encouraging. Dangerfield is some strange sort of Gnostic demiurge. The world we see around us in all its filth, pathos and iniquity is his, capital H, creation. So there you go. Give it a go. It's getting cracking reviews. Number one, new release. All right. What are you talking about?
Excellent. Okay.
Thanks for having me on, mate. Good luck with the rest of it. I'll be watching.
Okay. All right. And well done with the book, and well done for writing it. And I hope it continues to do well. All right. Yeah. That was Dangerfield for Millennial 2025. I'll be back soon with the next one. In the meantime, bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? The Millennial NFT is a unique animated vector graphic available for just one lucky owner. The auction closes on the 30th. Make your bid today. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.